This piece was brought to you by Whole Foods Market, wholefoodsmarket.com.
The difference between storytelling and journalism is, in journalism, you can't make things up. And in storytelling, you get to embellish. It's kind of like, you know, when you wake up in the morning and you're trying to remember your dream, and you start telling someone about your dream, and then you realize you're not sure that that's really what you dreamt, and then you realize it doesn't matter because it's all coming out of your head. And that's kind of the difference between storytelling and journalism, where when you're making a great story, the truth is whatever you want it to be, whatever in your head it is. Whereas in journalism, there is a real truth. And as somebody said to me in my very first review for the Los Angeles Times, you can't make stuff up. Because I had imagined being there with Gloria Swanson at this restaurant. He said, you weren't there with Gloria Swanson. She's dead. This is journalism, and you can only write about what really happened. I have never been a great journalist because sticking to the facts is very hard for me.
Heritage Radio Network proudly presents Evolutionaries, Ruth Reichel. In a world filled with food writers who take themselves and their opinions all too seriously, Ruth Reichel has been a constant breath of fresh air over her illustrious 40-plus year career. Her creative take on storytelling and restaurant reviews turned food writing upside down. She's authored a trilogy of best-selling memoirs, a novel, and a cookbook. She was the last editor-in-chief of the now-defunct Gourmet magazine. Before that, she was the restaurant critic of New West and California magazines, then the Los Angeles Times and New York Times. She co-owned the Swallow Restaurant from 1974 to 1977, playing a part in the Berkeley culinary revolution. She's produced and hosted television shows. She's a judge on Top Chef Masters. She's been honored with 6 James Beard Awards and numerous others. She's damn near done it all and shows no signs of slowing down.
I think a lot about what criticism is and what criticism is supposed to do. It seems to me that good criticism really gives the consumer of the critique, whether it's a book review or a movie review or a theater review or an art review, a better way to experience whatever that particular art is. And that, you know, when you read a really good art review, when you go to the museum and see the show, you are better equipped to absorb the art. And a really good theater review, you go to the theater and it's an enhanced experience for you. And I felt like a restaurant review should do that too. It should give you better tools to evaluate the experience on your own. And that it also felt really important to me to keep emphasizing to the readers that it's just your opinion. That you're a person, that you are not some genius who knows better than they do, that their opinion counts as much as yours, but that you're giving your opinion, you're giving a reason for your opinion, and you're hoping that your opinion will be useful to them in some way, but that it's not handed down from on high. And you know, I kept thinking about my father, who grew up in Berlin, always used to talk about what he felt was wrong with American newspapers, that they had this myth of objectivity. And he said, you know, my father would go to the coffee house and he would read 8 papers every day across the political spectrum. He would read really conservative papers and really radical papers and come away with his own opinion. And it seems to me that good criticism helps people form their own opinion rather than just say, Ruth Reichel says this is a great pizza, so it's a great pizza. So one of the things I really wanted to do in my reviews was to keep reminding people, it's not like I know more than you or that my opinion is more valuable than yours. You know, this is what I think, and I spend a lot of time thinking about these things, but go and see for yourself. Maybe I'm an idiot.
Did Ruth's story begins in New York City, in Greenwich Village, where she was raised. Her parents had roots in the art world, and her mother's famous dinner parties helped plant the seeds of passion for food that would later grow in Ruth's life.
I mean, my mother really loved to entertain. And the apartment I grew up in was a small two-bedroom classic New York apartment. And she liked to entertain so much that we didn't have bedrooms. I mean, every room was, we slept on pull-out sofas, so she could entertain in both bedrooms and the living room. So I think people had a wonderful time at her parties, even though the food was a disaster. And not always a disaster. I mean, sometimes it was fine, but often it was really scary. I mean, she really did make, you know, steak tartare out of, like, the markdown hamburger at the supermarket. And she really did make everything stew and was very proud of these messes that she made. But people constantly talked about what great parties she had. She had, I mean, well, first of all, you know, because she was bipolar, she only entertained when she was manic. And so she would invite wonderful mixes of people, people she would meet on the bus, famous writers that my father was designing their books, artists that she knew. I mean, she would get a great cross-section of really interesting New York people at her party. The kids that I went to school with at PS 41 were, I mean, even though it was the village school, most of the kids' parents were dentists and podiatrists and lawyers. And my parents' friends seemed more interesting and made me want to have that kind of life. And then, of course, I was very busy watching them all, trying to figure out, you know, who I liked and who I was going to save from my mother's most egregious dishes.
Ruth left New York to attend the University of Michigan, where she met her first husband, artist Douglas Hollins, and graduated in 1970 with a master's in art history. Her and her husband moved to Berkeley, California. There, she wrote her first cookbook and eventually opened her own place, Swallow Restaurant.
What I thought was, you know, I had written this cookbook. I had loved writing the cookbook, and I'd realized I really wanted to write. And so I was trying to write a novel. And that's what I thought I wanted to do, but I never thought I would make a living as a writer. So I thought that I would work in restaurants. And, you know, I started working with this collective in Berkeley. And I probably thought I would do that for the rest of my life, that I would work in the restaurant. Or actually, at the point that my life changed completely, I had this idea of starting my own little place. I was only going to do two things. I was going to make the world's best hamburger. We were going to make, I was going to get really good meat and hand chop it, bake my own buns, get really, you know, good toppings for them, and bake a pie every day. And that's all I would have, would be the world's best hamburger and a fabulous pie. And in those days, that was feasible. I mean, I could have done it, and I probably, some of the people in our collective probably would have come with me to do this. And, you know, some people had sort of split off from the Swallow to open a juice bar. And so I was thinking I was like the pie baker at the Swallow. So, you know, people came just to get my pies. So it was a feasible idea. One of my roommate's girlfriends wrote the Best Bets column for New West magazine, kind of like Corky Pollan did for New York. So Susan was writing the Best Bets, and she's not really a writer. She's an idea person. And she asked me if I would write them for her, which was a breeze for me. You know, they were like little, you know, 50-word things, but they had to be clever. So I started writing all of Susan's stuff, and then she had contacts at magazines in New York. So, I mean, I was still at the restaurant, but I was writing in partnership with Susan. And then we were doing all this stuff for New West, and then I decided to do a few pieces of my own for New West that were not with Susan, some food pieces. And one of our editors ate dinner in my restaurant most nights. And one night he just looked at me and he said, have you ever thought about being a restaurant critic? I was not thinking, oh, this is going to be my career. What I was thinking was free meals. They'll let me go and they're going to pay me to go out and have these meals. And, you know, my roommates, my friends were all thrilled because I was not only going to get these meals for myself, but I was going to be able to take people with me. And so for a little while, I was still at the restaurant and writing these reviews. And then it was clear that I really couldn't, you know, that was a real conflict. So I had to leave the restaurant. So suddenly I was like writing reviews for New West Magazine and going to all these fancy restaurants. And then, you know, then when you sort of are at a magazine, you can pitch ideas for anything. So I was, you know, pitching bigger ideas and they kept asking me to do more and more. And then the magazine was bought. It was owned by Murdoch. And then it was bought by the Texas Monthly people, and they decided to combine. There had been a Northern California and a Southern California edition, and they decided to combine the editions to only have one restaurant critic. And so they gave me the job instead of the LA person. So suddenly I was flying to LA to eat in restaurants in LA. You know, I'm still living in my commune in Berkeley, and they're all very disapproving. I mean, it's like one thing when you're just a person who's taking your friends out, but suddenly it's starting to seem like this is really the job that I have. And there was a lot of serious criticism of the notion of being a restaurant critic.
Ruth was the food writer and editor at New West Magazine for 4 years, where she would meet her husband, Michael Singer. Ruth made her mark at the Los Angeles Times as a restaurant editor from 1984 to 1993 and food editor and critic from 1990 to 1993.
I still was thinking that I was going to do this for a little while and then I would go back to my real life. I mean, I didn't think that it was my real life until the Los Angeles Times offered me a job. And that was like a real shock because I'd never had a job. And it was the first, I mean, I was so unused to the notion of having a job that I think we moved to LA in June for that job. And I remember going to the office on the 4th of July and like turning around and like, where is everyone? I mean, when you're a freelancer, there are no days off. There's no vacation. I was shocked that people weren't in the office on July 4th. I mean, I'd never had a job with benefits or health care or anything, you know, or I mean, at the restaurant, if you didn't want to work, you just found someone to cover your shift. And as a freelancer, if you didn't want to do it, you just didn't take a job. And suddenly I'm in a real job where I'm going to work every day and I'm the voice of Los Angeles restaurants. I mean, and really, you know, the most important voice west of the Mississippi in terms of restaurant criticism. And it suddenly felt like, oh, maybe this is my life. It had never occurred to me. You know, I love food so much, and I, you know, writing about restaurants is so much fun. It never seemed like work. It was just what I was doing, and, you know, my real life would start again. When I was at New West Magazine, I invented this form of restaurant criticism that was essentially short stories that wove the restaurant experience through it. So I did, you know, stories that were science fiction that were set on Mars and things set in the 17th century and love letters and love stories and westerns. And I just sort of made, I didn't make up any of the stuff about the restaurants, but I made up the surrounding, because I thought regular restaurant reviews were really boring. It was a horrible moment for me because I thought I will not write the kind of restaurant reviews that people, I mean, this is 1984, right? The kind of restaurant reviews that say, you know, eat this, don't eat that, a little bit too much salt. I mean, how am I going to make this interesting? And I realized that, you know, for me, it was the people that were interesting. So I started eavesdropping on other tables and making stories around what happened at the table. And I turned my husband into a character called the Reluctant Gourmet, who got to be the kind of, which is not a lie. I mean, Michael really is a guy who would rather, you know, eat hot dogs and beer than be in a fancy restaurant. But he was a great character for a restaurant critic to sort of like constantly stick pins in the pretentiousness of what I was doing. I got him to, you know, make fun of me. But I ended up using a lot of dialogue in these reviews in lieu of a Western or a love story, but still trying to make each review have a beginning, a middle, and an end, which they hadn't up until that point. But trying to make each one, you know, something that you would have to read all the way through to get the final impact.
After almost a decade at the Los Angeles Times, Ruth returned to her native New York City to work at the New York Times, a job too good to pass up.
So when I say I didn't want it, I really didn't want it. But, you know, Michael said, come on, it's the New York Times. And he was the news director of the CBS station in L.A., but when the Bureau said that he could go work in the New York Bureau, I knew it was like the stars were lining. I should take the job. You know, and I'm a New Yorker. And I do think the New York Times is just, it's a great newspaper. And it was too tempting, the idea of coming home. Unfortunately, neither of my parents was alive anymore. But, you know, I finally felt like I would be making them proud. You know, that I think writing restaurant reviews for the LA Times wouldn't have meant much to them, or doing the food section of the LA Times. But I think becoming the restaurant critic of the New York Times would have made them proud. And it was there in my head. And there's certainly no question that the difference in rigor at the New York Times was so different than the LA Times. You know, the first time I worked with a copy editor at the New York Times, I just couldn't believe the kind of proof that they were demanding of me. And they did say, you know, at some point you're going to get tired of doing the restaurant. Everybody does. Nobody does it forever. And then we want you to be an editor. You know, the section you did at the LA Times is really impressive, and you know, there's lots of editorial opportunities here. So I didn't feel like I was giving up being an editor forever. In those days, it was really a writer's paper. I would suggest stories to the person who was the food editor at the time, and she'd say, it's a great story, but I'll never get a writer to do it. And I would think, at the LA Times, that issue didn't come up. If I told a writer to do something, they did it. That didn't happen at the New York Times, and I started thinking being an editor there was not a bed of roses, that they got second-guessed a lot, they got criticized a lot. All that had ever really happened to me, I mean, once at the LA Times, when I did the Angelo Pellegrini story, and I had this big picture of Angelo on the front of the section, and Shelby came into my office, and he pointed at the word food, and he pointed at the picture of Angelo, and he said, this is not this. And I just started screaming at him. I said, you know, if what you want is all you want is pretty little recipes, you got the wrong person for this job. And he backed out and never said another word to me. You know, fortunately, the LA Times didn't have stars. And when I got to the New York Times, I mean, I said, I really hate the stars. I find them insulting to the readership. You don't put them on anything else. You don't ask your book critics, your theater critics, your film critics to put stars on something. And so Joe Lelyveld, I didn't bring it up when Max was the editor, but when Joe became the editor, he said, do you really want to seriously address the issue of getting rid of the stars. And I said, as a writer, yes, but as an editor, I would fight very hard against it because the stars work really well for the paper. You know, every time you give something 4 stars, there's a ton of publicity about it. And, you know, as an editor, I think you would be crazy to get rid of the stars. But I do think that they're insulting both to the critic and the readership.
In 1999, Ruth took the next major step in her career, assuming editorship of the famed Gourmet magazine, where she stayed until Condé Nast closed the magazine in October 2009.
When the notion of taking over Gourmet, which again, you know, I mean, I loved my job. I wasn't really ready to leave yet. But as my agent said, I said, I'm not ready to leave yet. And she said, the timing is never perfect. You never get offered a job when you really want it. I said, you know, if they just offer it to me like 2 years from now. And she said, yeah, but 2 years from now, somebody else will have that job. So, you know, it was an amazing opportunity. I mean, I thought when I talked to them about it and I said, you know, I am not going to do the magazine that you've got. And if that's what you want, you're the wrong person. James Truman said to me, you know, I came here thinking that what I wanted was an elegant dinner party, but you've persuaded me that I should be looking for so much more. And, you know, when I met with Cy, he said, I want it to be the best Epicurean publication in the country. And, you know, Michael said, you really think they're going to let you do what you want there? I said, yeah, I think they really are. And they really did. But it was very much this notion of why isn't there a publication that really reflects what's going on in the current side? I mean, this is 1999, and there wasn't an Epicurean publication that, you know, talked about farmers, that talked about what was going on with the food supply, that was really serious. I mean, it was all still kind of recipes and restaurants and fancy vacations. And, you know, what I said to Truman was, you know, Gourmet calls itself the magazine of good living. Don't you think good living should be more than just having a great time and stuffing yourself on fantastic food? I mean, don't you think that we should be thinking about what's happening to the planet? And, you know, I talked about climate change. And I said, you know, that to me is good living. And he said, yeah, go for it.
Ruth remains one of the most important thought leaders in food across many fields, but undoubtedly one of the most lasting impacts of her career thus far has been the way she transformed restaurant reviews.
If you're going to really write a fair restaurant review, you have to go many times. I mean, you have to go with 1 or 2 people and with a group of people. Because it's a very different experience if you're 5 people than if you're 1 person. You have to go on the weekend and on a weekday. You should go lunch and dinner. You should pretty much have eaten most of the food on the menu. Because every restaurant will have good things and bad things. And good days and bad days. And if you're at a big institution like the New York Times, the LA Times, or Gourmet, you're going to have a huge financial impact on the restaurants. And you really need to be fair. I would say in all journalism, fairness is the primary requisite. And I think that most restaurant reviews that get written today aren't fair because they're based on 1 visit or 2 visits. And it's just wrong. And it, again, it speaks to the issue of anonymity, which it's odd. Most male critics will tell you that being anonymous is not important. I think that's nonsense. I mean, I think it's very hard to be anonymous. I don't think you can always manage it. But to pretend that the experience of being in a restaurant is the same if they know that you can have a multi-million-dollar impact on their business or you're just some schmo who comes off the street, you know, that's crazy. It, you know, I know that, you know, what restaurants will do if they know that you're there is they'll surround you with people their friends. You know, they'll call up all their friends and say, come eat dinner. It's free on, and everybody will be having a wonderful time and it's a great atmosphere. And you haven't waited a minute for your table. And maybe the food doesn't change, but the experience changes. And restaurants are theater. They're not just what you're eating.
Ruth continues to inspire all in the food world and has become an outspoken leader, especially for women in food.
We all keep lamenting the fact that there's not a woman who's a Wolfgang Puck, a Danielle, a Jean-Georges. And there are a few reasons for it. And one is that these people are all funded by men, and we need to find an angel who will fund a woman. But beyond that, I think that women look for something different in their work life than men do. And they don't need the glory. And they're also often people who need to support their families. And I noticed it when I was looking at a union shop. And I looked in the kitchen and realized that it was mostly women. And I suddenly thought, oh, are women choosing jobs that have, instead of the possibility of becoming rich and famous, that offer security, health benefits, reasonable hours? And I think if you look at women in the food industry, you will find that, in fact, there is a kind of parity, that it's just that women have deliberately chosen not to be the big macho bull who needs to be, you know, the billionaire famous person, but in fact somebody who has a job that they like that offers them, you know, real security. It's a very different way of being in the world. And, you know, I mean, one of the things that we all know happens is that, you know, many women who, you know, start out being, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20, wanting to go into the food industry in their mid-30s, suddenly look around and go, wait a minute, if I want to have children, this is no life. Because, you know, being a restaurant chef, working a split shift, I mean, the hours are punishing. I mean, you see it over and over again. Women who love this industry and love this business choose to do other kinds of work. I think it's really important to recognize that, you know, for most of human history, women were not allowed to do interesting work. And, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of the couple generations before us who created these opportunities for us to be working women. And it is difficult. I mean, balancing your work life and your personal life is really hard. It's much hard. I mean, nobody begrudges men the time that they spend at work. Everybody has issues with women. They want to guilt trip you about it. Don't let that happen. That guilt is an indulgence, and bat it away. You deserve to have meaningful work. You know, we're really privileged in the first world to be able to make choices. Most of the women in the world can't make those choices. And as someone who can, I think you really have an obligation to not waste 1 minute of your life doing things that you don't like to do. And, you know, work hard, love your work, and if you don't love your work, find something that you do love. I mean, I think it's really important to follow your passion. Making a lot of money is nice, but, you know, at the end of your life, what do you have except a pile of money?
This piece was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee, with additional support by Julia Tershin and Austin Sherman. The songs used in this piece in order of appearance are I Love New York by Rectech, Anxieties by The Landing, Write It Down by The Landing, Creek Time by Odetta Hartman, We Are by The Landing, Fuck New York by Rectech, Dope Springs Eternal by Rectech, Kirkwood Gaps by Rectech, Untitled Dance Hall Rhythm by Knife Show, Strange Charm by The Landing, and once again, I Love New York by Rectech. Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.